Accession number 18624, Reel 5.
Mr. Sweet, Reel 5. You were saying about the hangars at Krill.
Yes, when we got down there, wading through all the mud and etc., of course, the aircraft had been just parked anywhere when we landed the night previously in the bad weather conditions. So we were able then to start trying to sort ourselves out. Things were very chaotic. No workshops available at that time. But it's amazing what people can do, and eventually we found suitable accommodation for crews and mechanics, etc., etc., and gradually things started falling into place, and we then started our training using the Firth of Forth to great use, torpedo dropping. We used the RAF ranges near Dundee for the bombing and the air firing, and the squadron started to build up into a very compact unit. I was still at the time flying with the CO and more or less in charge with a non-flying bloke in the next office. And then one day, we had the squadron party, and the non-flying petty officer, a little bit under the weather at some early hour in the morning. The CO had paid for the party to keep within the Scottish laws. This petty officer got a little bit under the weather and fell over the wall, sea wall. So, of course, he went into hospital, and then a volunteer petty officer, much senior to me, arrived from Arbroath Naval Air Station as the senior petty officer. So I then went back to always flying with the senior pilot and the senior navigator, and no responsibilities, which suited me fine. And we did all our working up exercises at Krail. We spent a couple of horrid nights in the air raid shelters with the German bombers coming overhead. But it was a nice station. The people were very friendly and very kind. We had our special pubs, of course, the Cambo Arms, and everything went quite smoothly. But come the spring, we had completed all facets of torpedo dropping, bombing, air firing, etc., navigating, etc., and it looked as though the aircraft carrier we were scheduled to join, which was the Victorious, was still stuck in Newcastle and nowhere near operation standard. So Commander Stokes volunteered the squadron to be attached to the RAF in that we could do something useful towards towards the war effort, as opposed to sitting around doing nothing. It went through all right. I don't know if there was any bitching from either side, but we suddenly then we gathered all our bits and pieces together, and tools and equipment, and we headed for Stornoway. And we were attached to an RAF Anson unit in Stornoway, doing convoy escorting, submarine searching, etc., etc. And we carried depth charges, so we at least were contributing to the war effort. The whole squadron was billeted in the castle, which dominates Stornoway, spacious rooms, etc., etc. And we all started to get associated with the locals. There was one spare aircraft, a Walrus, that was anchored in the harbour, but we never saw the crew at all. This went on, again, rather boring. There's nothing more boring than being in an aircraft looking for something that doesn't exist. I'd been taught as a boy, a sailor, when lookout, to flick the eyes around the horizon, etc., but not to stare. So it didn't bother me at all. But this went on. There was nothing untoward that happened. Until one day there came a signal sent out to us, all aircraft are returned to base. And so we all duly completed our landing at the airfield. The airfield, when we were first there, was a case of landing and taking off between the bunkers of the golf course. But by this time, I think, if my memory is right, they had completed a runway. We did have one aircraft crash land with his mine on the stern still under the wing, but nothing blew up, so everything was all right. And on landing, we were given 1 hour's notice to get our stuff together and leave what we couldn't take on the aircraft for the ground staff to pick up and bring down with them. And our destination was to be Leon Solent with a fuel stop at the RAF station just outside Liverpool to refuel. On arrival at Leon Solent, we were immediately bombed up with a torpedo with live warhead fitted, and our destination was then to proceed to RAF Thorny Island, which was to be our base, because there was a suspected dash up the channel, which, as history is shown, didn't materialize at that moment. So we finished up very tired at RAF Thorny Island, but they were very kind. Accommodation was found for us. The air mechanics and the ground staff had a far worse journey. They were lumbered around with trucks and what have you. We remained in that condition. The first few days, I think we did tour. We did not raids. We still had the torpedoes on the aircraft, but we did sorties over the French coast. I think mainly looking for invasion barges, but. Not always. We did do some sorties and ran into night fighters and had a bit of a harrowing time. This went on for another 4 or 5 days after but the torpedoes still remained shackled on, and then on the Sunday, I remember this Sunday so vividly, suddenly came the signal for the squadron to take off and proceed to RAF St. Evil, which was a coastal command station on the north coast of the peninsula there. Again, obviously, it was because of these ships tied up in Bordeaux Harbour, and that we were needed. We landed about 8 o'clock in the evening, again in not very good weather, but the RAF did provide sleeping accommodation, and we were able to have a meal. And then I think about 8:30 the sirens went, and we spent the whole night in the shelters of RAF St Devil. About 5 o'clock in the morning, a van went scurrying around all the trenches, ordering everybody to evacuate the airfield. Evacuate the airfield. So you can imagine, where do you go? I headed out one way and found myself hiding behind the anti-aircraft gun of the station defences, which was a bit stupid. So I did a 180 and scuffed somewhere else. One of the air gunners volunteered to drive an ambulance. You can't think of this. In our squadron of 36 flyers, Jeff Griffin was the only one that could drive. So he volunteered to drive the ambulance because it was a saturation bombing. They hit St Devil all night long. There was no let-up whatsoever. I can remember having strayed almost into St Mirren Airfield, which was a Fleet Air Arm, non-operational but training airfield, in a ditch. Cold, wet, and not very happy. Anyway, we crawled back in daylight. When the bombing ceased in daylight, got back to the airfield. The pilots and observers, the officers, were billeted in a hotel near Newquay accommodation. We were put in, the air gunners, we were put in Bedruthen Steps Hotel. We were in the hotel was occupied by RAF personnel, but there was an outhouse, and all 12 air gunners were able to kip down in the various rooms of this hotel. And then, of course, eventually we got transport was sent for us to take us back to the airfield. And it certainly was a mess. Fortunately, none of our aircraft were touched, which is a miracle, because we'd only parked our aircraft in where there was a blank space, and the Germans had concentrated their saturation bombing onto the buildings and admin parts of the airfield. But nevertheless, it wasn't a very pleasant experience. Anyway, we all got together and settled into the Bedruthen Steps Hotel. We found out where the nearest pubs were, and Newquay was quite a nice spot, and it was a midweek dance, so we were all back in the fine fettle. And then, of course, we then started the threat of the Channel Dash had been shelled for a little while, and the squadron spent the most days mine laying in the off the Brest approaches. It all sounded very easy going and no particular danger. But what we didn't know until we got there, that they were very active with night fighters and new equipment. So some of us had a very hairy act in evading these creatures and getting back to St. Evel. There was one funny or interesting situation. On one occasion, Cocky Reed and Prendergast, I think it was Prendergast, the observer, and myself, we were sent on a operation to necessitated us flying very, very close to the defences of Brest. And, of course, in an albacore, we didn't quite tie up with the modern bombers that RAF St. Evel had. And consequently, as we made our run of reconnaissance, we were so slow, all the people laugh when I tell them about this, that all the all the anti-aircraft fire that was being let out to us went up so far ahead we were in no danger. We just sat there and plodded on at our very slow speed and just turned and came back, and that was that. So we had a bit of a giggle on that. We, the sojourn at St. Evel was very good. The RAF were very helpful to us. Accommodation was a bit cramped, but then usually if anybody that's been in naval ships or depots, you can usually adapt yourself. And then again, one day came the alarm call, all their return to base immediately. Again, it was a case of an hour's notice to get your flying kit, your and your personal equipment together. And we were heading north now. And the main function of this move north was to position to Donibristle Airfield, where we would be fitted with the IFF gear. That's the identification friend or foe equipment, which had been introduced and was now standard equipment. If you didn't have that, then you're going to get shot at. That took for the completion of all 12 aircraft with the IFF gear, took several days. Some of us went to Crails, some of us went to Donibristle accommodation. But eventually we all finished up at Royal Naval Air Station Hatstone, which was in the Orkneys. And we stayed there and awaited developments with the carrier. Our carrier, HMS Victorious, had been hijacked by another squadron who was more conveniently situated to do the attack on the Bismarck. Otherwise, it would have been 827 squadron there, but my friend Les Sayer was with the pilot that, with the CO that attacked the Bismarck on our first operation. So we had to wait then for that episode of the war before we could board our aircraft, and that was done at Hatstone. I was quite happy because my father was there. And again, one would laugh. I was by that time a petty officer, fairly senior, and my father was my messman. I offered to come and eat out in the galley with him. He says, "No way." He said, "You've got your promotion, you use it. And I went ashore one night, looking for birds, of course, and a pint or two. And I came back fairly late, and I thought, well, I'll look in the kitchen to see if the old boy was there. And I walked in there, and he was sitting there with four wrens. He had a personality, I think. So that leads up to the big do. A lot of training was done doing low flying over the islands of the Sound, and you know, all things you associate with a big raid. Nobody said anything, nobody told anybody anything, but obviously something big was on. And eventually it came. The Victorious came round, and we embarked, and we actually headed north. We ran through one of our own minefields, an HMS Ardent. One of the flanking destroyers got blown up, and a very severe loss of life. And we were heading for Sedgwick. You'll have to look on the map how to spell it, for refueling. And it was common knowledge to all of us in the squadron saying, what the bloody hell are we doing? What we're doing now, and that is, in a strike force, heading north, open sea, Norway occupied, Sweden occupied, everything occupied by the Germans. So where do they think we're going? To the North Pole? You know, it was so ridiculous. We've lost a destroyer already. And, you know, that took 2 days to get up to Sedgwick and refuel. We were given permission to walk ashore. Well, we couldn't. We stayed with our aircraft. And then we started heading round. For we'd then been told our target, Kirkness. Well, you're going round the whole length of Norway. And did they honestly think, blame was put on Churchill, partly, but what about the Sea Lord? He surely had enough knowledge of the Navy and geography of... You can't take a task force around that area of land and not be seen by somebody. And the Germans were no ruddy fools. So we headed for Kirkness. The briefing was a shambles. No air gunners attended the shambles, unlike the RAF with their concentrated meetings, you know, everybody gets in there, they're told everything, what's there, what's they've got to do. Nothing like that on the ruddy Victorious. In fact, the worst thing that happened to us was at that stage, Lieutenant Commander Stokes was promoted to Commander Flying and appointed to HMS Eagle, which was in the Mediterranean. So we lost our CO. And that one movement of removing a pilot from heading the squadron and substituting an observer as CO of the squadron necessitated 7 aircraft crew changes. Now, I've never seen anybody admit to this cock-up in any publication. I've got the official report from, you know, the top brass. That stupid movement, you destroy the integration of a fully trained squadron with 7 changes. And in fact, my pal Jeff Griffin, who was flying in 4M, and was shot down and taken prisoner of war, only met his pilot, who was the replacement for Commander Stokes, as he walked out to his aircraft to take off. And this is, I can't understand it, the intelligence of whoever organised this. I had no time for the Vice Admiral in charge, Wake Walker. Two squadrons, well, nearly three squadrons, were destroyed in a stupid act like that. No wonder our losses were so bad. Right, on the the aircraft were lined up to take off from the Victorious, we were all aware of the fact that the force had been spotted. Obviously, I mean, you can't go all the way around flipping coast and not be seen. So we were committed to go. There has been rumours since that the CO, this observer that had taken over from Commander Stokes, should have cancelled it out then. But I don't doubt for one moment he was overridden by the Rear Admiral, who was CO of the whole operation. So, personally, I looked at the observer, Prendergast, and I said, right, we're in for it this time. We were in the second scene of flight, 4K. So A, B, and C, and F, G, and H would take off before us. Then our turn. Got airborne and settled down for the flight in. We were at about, I suppose, 500 feet. As we approached the coast, we were aware that there was a hospital ship at the entrance to the Kirkenes Harbour. Obviously, they were telling their authorities what we were up to, and still we pressed in on. I wasn't at the briefing. No air gunners were attended, so we didn't know what were the tactics going to be. We were just like lambs going to a ruddy slaughter. We were aware that 828 Squadron was bearing to the right, which would have taken them to the harbour entrance, and I gather I found out afterwards that literally eight aircraft went through the approach into the harbour, the German gunners were firing down at them. So, you know, it was a trap. We, I don't know whether this is spoken about, certainly I didn't know which what our approach was going to be into the fray. I assume that all the nine aircraft behind the leader just followed him down the fjord, which was to the east of Kirkenes Harbour. Low level, when we got to the end of this fjord, of course, we had to go up to get over the top, and I can remember seeing some people from a farmhouse waving to us as we flashed over about 100 feet, and then, of course, we dropped down into the harbour. Standing on the stirrups at the back of the aircraft, I was able to look forward and see something of what was going on. Obviously, there was a lot of puffs of smoke, etc., etc., and as we dropped down, I was aware of a Panzer type of vehicle on the cliff side on one side, which I gave a short, sharp burst of fire to them. But with a single gun, you can't do very much about it. And then, of course, the pilot, Pissy Albert, as we called him, was trying to find a target, because there wasn't any target. We'd been told the ship was a mass of fatty shipping. And all I could see is one merchant ship down...